You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is the brilliant Will Durst, a comedian with many, many years of experience under his belt. You are going to find out just what he's up to at the moment, what he's been up to over the last 30 plus years, I think. And this is an episode recorded at the Edinburgh Festival earlier this year. And this was one recorded at the fabulous Black Medicine Coffee Shop under the auspices, whatever that means, of the PBH Free Fringe. This is Will Durst. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Stuart.
Have a seat. So, that was a good... That's a very good introduction. Well done. Lovely.
Hi. Hello. You're not, I know it's late.
Yeah, it is late. It is late. Sorry about that, everyone, but we're trying to build this as the thinking person's late night alternative, because most shows on around now are about people getting hammered and screaming shit at comedians. And someone in the audience nodding as if to go, yeah, I was planning to go to one of them. So, Will, tell us, for those of us who don't know you, people will be listening to this all over the place, but for those of us not familiar with your work, could you just briefly describe who you are and where you come from?
Oh, geez, I have no idea. I'm a stand-up, always wanted to be a stand-up. My ma says, when I was 6 years old, I asked her where I could go to school to become a stand-up comedian. And I went to the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. I studied journalism and theater and film and broadcasting. I kind of approached it from all four different angles. So when I finally did stand-up, it wasn't a huge leap. You know, it was a tiny little step because I had written my own material, and I had been on stage doing plays and stuff. So I just started doing political stuff because when I started in 1974, before many of you were even glints, everything in America was political for about 8 years because of Vietnam. So 74 was the end of Vietnam. It was Watergate had just happened. And so everything that we had been kind of forged in a crucible. So I was political. It wasn't all political. A lot of it was about the town that I was in, Milwaukee. And then I had to leave. So at the time, there were three cities where you could make money doing stand-up comedy. And they were Chicago, Boston, and San Francisco. Not New York and L.A. because everybody's willing to do it for free for exposure.
Even then?
Oh, yeah.
In 1974?
Yeah, yeah.
What was the comedy landscape like in 1974? Who were the heroes? Who were the Louis C.K.'s and the Chris Rocks in 74?
Well, comedy, it kind of died when Kennedy was killed. And, yeah, there was no humor. Everybody was depressed. And then Steve Martin made Goofy funny again. So did Robin Williams. and Cheech and Chong and George Carlin and Richard Pryor and all those guys. But they were all political, and then Steve Martin came along with the arrow through his head, and he kind of brought people back. And then Saturday Night Live. So that was a landscape. There were clubs in New York and L.A. There were the improv clubs and the Comedy Store in L.A. And there were a couple of headliner clubs around, but not that many.
And who was starting out at the same time as you?
Everybody. Everybody. It was outcasts and misfits and square pegs that didn't fit into round holes and not just square pegs, hexagonal pegs. I mean, just odd looking pegs, because there was no money in it. There was no money in it. And then about 10 years later in 84, cable discovered stand-up comedy because it was so cheap to produce. You didn't have to hire writers because comics were self-contained, and you didn't have to pay music fees. So cable kind of created the comedy circuit in America.
So when you it's fascinating to hear you say that, because something that I wonder if it's perpetuated, I wonder if it's perpetually a cliche amongst stand-up comedians, the idea that, like, well, 10 years ago, people did it for the art. And now, of course, everyone's in it for a career. Because that's something we say now about contemporary comedy. People go, oh, you know, the guys that started but maybe 20 years ago, there was no career plan. Certainly in the UK, there was no, you know, it was like the birth of alternative comedy 20 or maybe right, even 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And nowadays, people are kind of grumbling, and older British comics are going, oh, it's unbelievable. Everyone's in it with a game plan now, the T-shirt comedians, the teeth comedians. You know, they're just in it to try and get famous.
Well, did you have an explosion of television featuring stand-up comedy?
That has, I mean, the most recent explosion probably started, what, 7 years ago? When did Live at the Apollo start? Maybe within the last 10 years, certainly.
Yeah,
so maybe
that's
they're
been
right. The most recent one.
Maybe they're right.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that was, so even when you started in 1974. There was already, were there kind of lines drawn as to these are the people who are being artistic and alternative?
No, everybody was, because cable didn't happen until, I mean, cable, HBO started doing on location things with, but there was just Robert Klein and Carlin and people who were already famous and touring. You know, it wasn't until Evening at the Improv discovered they went on a cable channel, and it proliferated. And one time they were running three times a day, an hour. And A&E, this arts and entertainment network in America, they were known as the Comedy and Nazi Channel. Because they had...
We totally still have that.
Yeah, they had history. So they were always doing, you know, features on Hitler. And then they would have a stand-up comedy show. So it was very eclectic.
And how did you bring yourself to it? You say you were doing lots of other jobs. How old were you when you actually did your first open mic?
I had tried doing stand-up comedy, but I didn't know what I was really doing. But I put together an act because I was writing for a local underground newspaper. And it was a humor column, so I took all the funny parts and I put them together into a stand-up comedy set. And the first time I died, a horrible death, horrible. But I had 7 minutes. I had memorized my routine. And, you
That's
know,
very unusual for someone's very first
The
gig.
First 7 minutes is the toughest.
Yeah.
You know? And the second time you do a gig is the toughest, because the first time, usually you do well because you have all this nervous energy and you've been focusing on it for so long and you memorized it. And then sometimes you invite your mates down to watch you and support you, and so you do halfway decent because you got all that adrenaline, and then the second time you go up and you die, and when you die everything is highlighted. When you die on stage, when you do well, it's a blur. It's the way you always heard it should be. You're floating on a rainbow and carried by clouds, and the wings of angels are carrying you into the sun. But when you die, time slows down, and every syllable is highlighted in 24-point font and in that bright yellow, and you remember every little thing. So, yeah, I know three guys who did stand-up comedy twice. The first time they killed, and the second time they went on stage and they died and they never did it again because it didn't make any sense. You know, it's like when you feed information into a computer twice, you get the same result. Well, an audience is not like that.
So what was it about you that kept you going past that first death?
Oh, I'm really stupid.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Say,
I wanted to do it. And
why
when it works, it's so good. When it works, it's better than sex and drugs and rock and roll and chocolate. And it's better than anything when it works. When you're on that and every syllable and every gesture in the audience kind of bonds with you. And then you come off stage and the next voice you hear is from a waitress. Behind you, you know, and boom, you're mortal again.
So when you were, I just want to stay with the idea of what, like you know that now, you know that's what you got from it now, but you aged however old you were in 74?
I was 22.
22 years old. You didn't know at that point that it was going to be like that. So when you did that first gig and you bombed and you died, like what separated you from those three friends of yours who tried it once, did well, tried it once, bombed, and then gave up? What was it you were hungry for? Was it the attention? Was it artistic expression? What was your prime drive?
I just had always enjoyed stand-up comedy. And I remember we had Johnny Carson, and Johnny Carson in the Midwest was on at like 10:30 at night. And so I could convince my parents to let me stay up and watch the comic on Carson. And he would have a comic on maybe three times a week. He was very generous. And they were all different. And I just thought it was so... You know, a man and a microphone. And I tried theater and I couldn't get any parts because I got a face like an overbaked potato. So there weren't a real lot of, and when you're on stage, it's just you. And I tried sketch groups and comedy groups and that's, it's like being in a band. I don't know if you've ever been in a band, but when you try to get four egos together, show business egos, there's always some clash. And one guy, all he wants to do is rehearse. He just wants to rehearse. And he's not worried about actually doing the gig on stage. And then there's the other asshole who just wants to get on stage. And that was me. And didn't want to rehearse. And then there's the lovers quarrel and, you know, the drummer who's always homeless. Well, every group has every comedy group has a drummer in it. But stand-up comedy, and my wife is an improviser, and my wife is much funnier than I am. But she does voices. She was in a movie called Nightmare Before Christmas. She did three voices in that.
Which, I've got to ask you, which voices she did? I know that
she
movie.
Did The Little Witch and The Corpse Child and The Corpse Mom. She's amazing. She's the one who goes, "There goes Christmas," which, she worked with Robin Williams in San Francisco before he got Happy Days, you know, which led to Mork and Mindy.
Okay.
But he was a star in San Francisco. But she knew him when he was the funniest guy in the room, not the funniest guy on the planet. So my wife is much fun, but she can't. She's done it a couple of times where she emceed something, but she works off of other people. You know, when you have that improv thing and it's just boom, 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 and nobody's thinking. I work from a script.
Okay.
I work from a script.
I've always been, I don't know if you share this at all, but I've always been really jealous of improv guys because they seem so happy. They're in a group. They don't feel all lonely and isolated because they travel together, they work together, and they don't have to spend any time writing. Do you know what I mean?
Or memorizing lines. Yeah, yeah.
But that's interesting. The difference that you hit upon there was that you are scripted. And so there's the question of ego and the fact of you wanting the limelight for yourself, and also that you're scripted. So the stuff that you were scripting, was that driven by, I mean, were you doing political satire at that time? Were you angry at the government and that's why you were writing?
I was so angry. I look at tapes from me, you know, from 79 and 80 when I just started out, and I'm wondering, why the hell is he so angry, you know? Dude, settle. yeah, and It was a time of revolution, and comedy was the new rock and roll in the 80s because it was that same group of activists that thought they stopped the war when it was just, you know, the corporations just gave up. It wasn't, you know, it had a little to do with the activists, you know, stopping and the revolutionary spirit. But so the 80s, that same group was going out, but they were going to comedy clubs because they were too old to stand up for a concert, and they wanted to sit down, and they wanted to hear the lyrics because that was a lot to do with who was coming to a comedy club. And also, you could take, you know, every generation says this, oh, we had artists, you know, but it was like verbal jazz. I mean, that's why people came, and there were guys who were incredibly funny who never made it, who you don't know of, but there were also guys, you know, at the time in San Francisco, Dana Carvey and Robin Williams and a bunch of guys, who Rob Schneider, guys who, you know, went on to Saturday Night Live, and it was it was like the Left Bank, you know. I mean, San Francisco, because we had more opportunity, and the audiences thought they were smarter. They weren't necessarily smarter, but they thought they were smarter because they lived in San Francisco, and San Francisco has this attitude, right, about itself. So it was a time.
And what was your relationship to the comedy community at the time? Were you someone who was, like, what were you known for? If someone said, like you described the members of the band, you know, if in the members of the, you know, the green room of a comedy club, what were you known for?
I don't know. The professor, I guess.
Why did you say that?
I was, because I used big words. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is that because you were clever or because you were San Francisco as well and you thought you were clever?
Okay. Yeah. Just try to be clever. Try too hard sometimes.
And how were you writing? What did a week look for you? Would you sit down and actually write out stuff longhand, or would you take ideas on stage? When you said you were scripting, how would you approach the process of turning an idea into a workable piece of material?
Well, I write a column right now, and it's a political humor column that gets syndicated in the U.S. And I find that I can take a line from the 550 words that I'm writing, and it might be one line that is stage worthy because it's two totally different voices. And so learning that and learning how to transfer it to the stage took forever. But also, I love that deadline. I love having to come up. Like, after this, I have to go home and write because I have a deadline tomorrow noon. This time, I have to hand in something. So I love that deadline because, you know, somebody else is counting on me. If it's just me, you know, I can put it off and I'll get to it later, you know, but somebody else is. So I always seek out those situations where I have an enforced deadline by somebody else.
Okay. And so you've got so put us in the shoes. I mean, would you have had deadlines when you were in your 20s, or would you, like, kind of the sort of deadlines I imagine are kind of like you book yourself in for a gig and then you've got to come up with material for that new show?
Yeah, we didn't have new shows. We we just did the same material. But because I was doing political stuff, everything has a sell-by date. Everything has a shelf life. And some of them are a couple weeks, and some of them are 6 months, and some of them, I'm still doing a Reagan joke. Remember when Reagan was shot and he didn't know he was shot? I don't know about you. I'd like a president with a central nervous system. So, I mean, some stuff you can just carry it on or bring it back, but some stuff is very internal, you know, like very fragile. So I was always writing. I was always writing.
And I just want to zero in on that process of writing. Are you kind of reading stuff in the newspaper, getting angry about it, and then trying to unpack it, trying to pull it apart? What kind of principles did you write to?
I learned through osmosis. So I don't listen to music. I had to give that up because it was so complicated. It was like a life's work listening to music. You know, I mean, learning about it. And so I listen to news talk radio.
Okay.
I don't read novels anymore. I just read magazines and periodicals and websites. So I learn through us just by reading all that stuff, I learned who the characters are, and I also learned the buzzwords and the phrases, because comedy is so idiosyncratic. It's so full of idiom. You know, that's why a lot of UK comics come to the States and it doesn't float, and the reverse happens true, because, you know, you guys know all your commercials from your youth, and a comic can go on stage and just mention like one little prepositional phrase and you know what he's talking about it. And we do the same thing with our, you know, cultural references, which don't always translate. So I still see it as verbal jazz. I still try to distill as much into, you know, as little words as possible.
I know almost nothing about jazz, and it, like actual musical jazz, but I'm just to kind of get my head around the analogy. I don't know, but I think I've got this kind of preconception that jazz guys are always trying to make something new, always trying to not play the same note twice, not play the same melody twice. They would have to play the same note. Do you find as a writer, regarding your comedy as verbal jazz, do you find that there are certain habits or tropes of writing that you catch yourself doing and have to try and steer clear from? Like, do you ever spot a thing and go, I've sort of done that shape of a joke before?
No, you can use that sometimes as, you know, as a backbeat, as a rhythm. You can use that. You have to know when to get off of it. I find that sometimes I'm a little too clever by half, you know.
Okay.
I have a joke that I do in my little act, and I'm doing a show not about politics. I'm doing a show about being a baby boomer, because it's cheating. I'm hoping that, you know, I could do the same show in front of the same group of baby boomers and it'll always seem fresh to them. So the idea is to have something that's evergreen.
Topical and yet timeless.
Yes.
Yeah, nice.
And what I do is I do a joke about it's too many words. It's about piercings. It's about, you know, piercings of food servers. Shouldn't there be a limit on the number of piercings allowed on food servers? Just seems like a lot of extra crevices for the breakfast to lodge and crust over, right? And I found that crevices is a wrong word. Crevices doesn't work. All I have to do is use holes. It just seems like a lot of extra holes, but I love crevices. So I keep trying to sell it, even though I know holes gets a better laugh, you know, yes. And I keep trying to sell crevices.
My favorite lines from your show, and I'll murder it if I try and say it myself, but there is a line in which you describe, it's the Balinese hexagram or a pentagram. What's that line? Do you remember?
It's like no idea.
Polynesian hexagram.
Petroglyph.
Petroglyph. That's it.
Yes.
Tell me what a petroglyph. Oh, tell what bit is that in? Because I just want to try and explore.
Oh, it's the password bit about, you know, you can't use password as the word password. Red bar. You know, your new password has to have 6 characters, no more than 12. It's got to have a capital letter, non-consecutive numerals, 2 punctuation marks, and a Polynesian petroglyph.
That's it. I told you I'd murder it, but. Like something like that. That to me, I really made me laugh when I heard that line. And part of what I like about it is its overwrittenness.
Yes.
So it's almost like a good example of that. Like you're almost making fun of your own tendency to overwrite.
Exactly. Yeah. And also it's about technology, you know, and how because they keep extending it. You know, it used to be you could use password 123 as your password. You know?
Yeah.
I miss the old days.
So this is Will. I've got so much to tell you, I am going to crack straight into the admin and we'll get back to Will as soon as we possibly can. I hope you're enjoying this conversation. Lots to talk about. Let me start with this. This is a quick email from a listener called Ren, Always lovely to meet someone called Ren. Obviously, Ren and Stimpy is my favourite Ren, and I can still sing the Canadian Kilted Yaksman song by heart. But this is Ren Reynolds. He sent me a very lovely email to do with his digital stickers and a potential opportunity there. But he also said he ended his email, "Thanks again, as I find the podcast fascinating and I'm doing the thing of," which I consider that a Goldsmithism of saying, "I'm doing that thing of, blah, blah, blah," and as well as the other thing I say. And now that I pointed out, you're going to find it maddening to hear me say it, is I apparently often go, "I just sort of feel like," and then whatever I feel like after that. He says, "Thanks again. I find the podcast fascinating and I'm doing the thing of dip, dip, dip. Okay, fuck it. Episode 1, episode 2, episode 3, which makes me feel like we should have a hashtag dip, dip, fuck it. But I don't know if I approve of promoting swearing on tweets, but I think that would also make me laugh. Loads to tell you about the tour. Before we get into that, I would like to remember to thank the correct Podblin for this episode, which is the marvellous Olivia Phipps. So thank you very much for logging the episode for me. And also Nathan Wood is, as ever, the editor, the producer of the show. There's going to be another kind of person on board, which is which I'll tell you more about later on. Because the okay, should we do the tour now? No, we'll do the tour in a minute. Tickets are on sale now for Soho Theatre for the new run of Soho shows. I'm releasing the first official date, the first official person booked, which, as you know, means that I've booked one official person, and that is the 4th of January. It's none other than Izzy Sutty. I cannot wait to have Izzy on the show. She is a wonderful, wonderful person, a very, very funny comic. You'll know her, I'm sure, if you're struggling to recollect that name from somewhere. She is Dobby on Peep Show, and she's also a brilliant musical comedian in her own right, often compared to Victoria Wood. In terms of her, she's just got a real grip on people and what makes people tick. She's very, her persona on stage is very innocent, very kind of blithe and guileless and just a joy to watch. Very, very funny. Izzy Sutty is going to be my guest at the Soho Theatre on the 4th of January. You can go to sohotheatre.com, and as ever, you can put in the usual code word. What's the usual code word? It's FAF. All capitals, I believe, but try it in all variations if that doesn't work. FAFF at sohotheatre.com to book tickets for Izzy Sutty on the 4th of January. I'll be bringing you the next two names in that run as soon as I know them. So that's that. And another little blurb. Thank you for your donations. The donations continue to trickle in, and I'm always very grateful to see them. I'm always very grateful to have my phone beep and go, "Oh, someone's remembered they love the show and they'd like to support it and they'd like to donate 5, 10, 20 pounds or whatever else they seem they feel is relevant, sometimes considerably more than that. So thank you to someone that dropped a 50 on me recently. It's very kind, and it all goes towards making the show an increasing part of my life, I should say, and making it bigger, wider and broader, and giving me the funds to do crazy shit like go to LA and take risks on things and take risks on the Soho run and just try and get more and more guests. The fact of the Soho run has inspired me and instigated me into making lots more offers to lots more interesting people, not all of whom have got back to me, not all of whom want to do a live show. But there are some very exciting names in the pipeline and even more to come. If you don't want to do a one-off donation, you can do a recurring donation. All of these things at comedianscomedian.com. Press the button on the page or go to comedianscomedian.com/donate. And you can set up a recurring donation if you like via any number of systems that I've proudly put on there. And those are great because even if you just donate £1 a month or £2 a month, whatever you like, then hopefully you forget that you set that to donate, and then years later, I own your house. And that's what we're going for. Come on. That's the system. But if you find that you're one of those people who, when I mention donations, you go, "Oh, yeah, I love the podcast. I want to give them a little something, something." And then you often find yourself thinking that. Who is it? Is it Dan Evans has got a brilliant joke about only... Oh, it's Sean Locke has got a great joke about only remembering you need to buy a new pillow when you're in bed encountering your old pillow, and you're away from any means to buy a new pillow. So if you're one of those people, set a recurring donation if you please. And if you'd like to support the show without donating, two new things to do. One, you can buy via the Amazon widget, which is on the donate page. Anything you buy through that Amazon window, even if it's not something I've recommended, there's a couple of things, a Patton album, and of course the Steve Coogan audiobook of I, Partridge, read by Steve Coogan in the character of Alan Partridge, and it is superb. Those are the recommendations. if you click on the Amazon widget, you can buy other stuff from Amazon and I get a little kickback, probably some sort of micro percentage, but it all helps in the long run. And the other thing you can do, and this is fun, we'll come up with a name for this when we think of one. But you know, I often ask you to share the show, to get a video of it, or take your favorite thing from comedianscomedian.com, go to that blog page, you know, that episode of the show, and paste it on someone's page. No one does that. Of course, well, maybe you do, but I don't think many people do that. Of course you don't. Why would you? It's not fun. I tell you what is fun is next time you're talking to someone about the show or having a conversation about podcasts at all, and one of those crazy people that doesn't know or understand what podcasts are says, oh, yeah, I'm not. You say, are you a podcast person? And they go, oh, yeah, I've heard one or two. And it's patently obvious that they're lying and they're frightened of the technology. We know how easy it is, but they don't. So what you do is you snatch their phone off them. You go, give it here. And then you hit the podcast app, which is inbuilt now in most models. Search for this show. Subscribe to this show. Pick an episode that you think is good. Do remember to subscribe, because that way they keep downloading them, even if they don't want to. And they'll be too scared to learn how to stop it happening. And get your favorite episode and go, bang, that's that one. That's the Patton Oswalt one. That's Kalman. That's Jason Byrne. That's Pasco. Whichever one it is, chuck it on. And there, you can just listen to it. Give it back to them. Do give it back to them. That's an essential part. Give it back to them and they can get stuck into that. That is just one of those are four or five of the ways you can support this show. Now, we come to a way that you can support me if you'd like to. You know I'm on tour. You know I'm going to go to all manner of exciting places. And if you're someone who lives in one of those places, you can do a thing to help me. I know, you know, I mentioned I wanted animators on the Buxton episode. What was that, like 6 months ago? I'm still getting emails from people going, yeah, I'll animate for you for free or mates rates or profoundly expensive, but I'm brilliant. I just love that you want to help me and you want to help the show. So here is a very tangible way you can support the tour that I'm about to do. And remember, at the end of all of my tour shows of last year's show, last Edinburgh show, it's called An Hour, I'm going to do a little 10-minute secret Q&A afterwards, off the record, where you can ask me whatever you like about the podcast. So there's another little reason to come and see it. But if you're someone who lives in one of the cities that I'm visiting, the cities and towns, which are, a quick list here, I shall do it quickly, Birmingham, Nottingham, Kingston, Windsor, Crawley, Manchester, Bristol, Southend, Canterbury, Aldershot, Hemel Hempstead, Milton Keynes, Bath, Norwich, Leicester, Corby, Wolverhampton, the Soho Theatre shows have just gone on sale as well, and Sutton, if you live in any of those places, send me an email, info@comedianscomedian.com, with the subject line cavalry. This is me calling in the cavalry. Basically what happens is if you're someone who works with other people, if you work in a bakery that other bakers work in, or if you work in an office, or if you're a teacher and you've got a staff room, if you've got some sort of corkboard or public space, shared space, that you could put up one of my posters for the show. If you're in a school in Windsor and you go, yeah, I'm going to go and see Stu, why don't I put up a poster in the staff room? Just email me with cavalry in the subject line. Tell me your address, how many posters you need, or flyers, or whatever it is you want. And I'll send you one, and you stick it up in the staff room. And it's win-win, because people will go past and say, who put that picture of that handsome comedian who appears to be nibbling his fingers in a slightly self-conscious way? Who put that there? And you'll say, oh, I did, because I'm really connected to the world of comedy. And this guy is a guy with whom I have a special podcast relationship. And they won't understand what that means. And they'll go, great, I'll come too. And everyone will bring all of their friends. And I will not lose thousands of pounds at a time when I have a new baby. So that's the plan. Cavalry in the subject line, give me your address and tell me where you can stick a poster and I'll send you one to stick. I think that's everything for now. Where's my little notes gone? Hashtag dip dip, fuck it, cavalry, faff@sohotheatre.com, buy through in the Amazon widget. We've thanked Olivia Phipps. Finally, we've remembered to thank the correct Podblin. That's it for now. That was a long one, I know, but I'm excited. I've got lots of irons in the fire. I think this is all the result of October. What I do is I finish Edinburgh. I have September kind of nominally off. I do some festivals, do some gigs, but I don't worry about writing. October, I go, okay, this is a new thing this year. This is Podmin month. I'm just doing podcast stuff. And then November, I go, oh, holy Christ, I've got to write a new hour. I might even have 15 minutes of it. I had such a good gig the other day. I'm really looking forward to the next one. But I think this is the reason I'm all full of beans at the moment is there's so much going on and so much new stuff. I'm definitely going to have to do this October every year, do the Podmin thing. I might chuck one in March or April as well. So that's it for now. I will now emerge from underneath my duvet and get back to my real life. Remember, the Comedians Comedian Podcast is not a substitute for writing your Edinburgh show or your tour or your dental lecture or your blurb for your website about your cakes or your crazy poetry as you run around and walk your dog. So get back to it after we return to Will Durst.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
One of the things that was very interesting about your show that I was laughing at the time, but afterwards I was reflecting on it, is I don't know if I've seen someone in their 60s doing observational stand-up material about being in your 60s.
Well, it's not popular. As you can tell from my attending crowds, because people don't want to admit that they're old and they're afraid that I'm going to do a show about, you know, euthanasia or something.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to start advocating.
Death is in town, isn't it? Yeah. Is that the issue? Yeah.
But in L.A., you know, they're so focused on youth and, you know, you're old at the age of 30. I've heard of comics who have been told, you know, we're just looking for people under 30, and yeah, they've been told to get off the stage. Nobody's willing to do a show like this in L.A., but I live in San Francisco, where which is not the real world. It's not.
So we were with you in your 20s. Describe for us the kind of the trajectory of your career from working in the 70s and 80s. You then, because it's quite magical to look at your YouTube videos and see a selection of men in wildly different clothes, hairstyles, comedy rooms.
Never had a persona. I was just the angry young man. I started out in San Francisco, and in San Francisco back then, because it's one of the tertiary markets, it's not New York and L.A., is where the cameras are plugged in. So that's why everybody goes there. So in San Francisco, when I got there, there was five levels where you were an open micer, and then you became an MC. Someone trusted you to book you for a show for an entire week. And then you were an MC, and then you were a middle act, and then you were a headliner, and then you moved to L.A. And that was the entire maturation of it. You know, it's and, you know, the evolution of comic. And so you moved to L.A., but then the scene expanded so horizontally, you know, because we started out with three comedy clubs in 1984, and by 1994, within a 90-mile radius of San Francisco, there were 15 full-time comedy clubs that you could drive to and come home. So you could book each club twice a year. That means that's 30 weeks of work a year. So I spent a lot of time in the Bay Area.
And when you say weeks of work, are you getting booked for an entire week?
Wednesday through Saturday or Tuesday through Sunday. Some of them are Tuesday through Sunday. Not anymore. Now it's usually Thursday through Saturday.
Yeah.
It's a full-time comedy club.
Yes. Yeah. There are certainly places in Britain, commercial comedy clubs, that used to do two shows on a Friday, two on a Saturday and a Sunday. And now they're doing one show on a Saturday.
Ooh.
Yeah, that hurts. Ooh. that's within my lifetime, within my comedy lifetime.
Well, at the peak, because comedy was so huge, and you had all these comics, and yet there might have been 40 full-time comedy clubs in America in 1984. By 1994, there were 440. There were four in Knoxville, Tennessee, and Knoxville, Tennessee could not support four comedy clubs.
How many comics were working? I don't need a number from you, but in the sense of how saturated did the circuit feel? Did it still has it always felt viable as a career?
Like certainly with the contraction of the circuit in the UK.
Oh, not anymore. No. I have to run twice as fast just to stay in the same place. Because I'm too old for the comedy clubs right now. As the average age of a comedy club in the States is 18 to 35. Has been, is now, forever shall be. God bless you. And something happens at age 35. So the comedy clubs want their comics to reflect the generation of people who are in attendance, and so do the audience. The audience doesn't want to see some old fart on stage. Look at these girls. They're bored out of their skulls. and well should you be. But I come on stage, and I'm talking about politics, and the kids just stare at me like, why is this bitter old man lecturing me? So I have found a different path. I do one-man shows now in theaters because people will still come to see me in a theater.
How do you feel about that comedy club booking policy? Does that rankle? Do you feel like you can still say stuff that's relevant? Do you feel hard done by the clubs?
Oh no, it's just what it is. You know, I still work a couple of clubs. I work a club in Boston, a club in Chicago, a club in San Francisco, Seattle. You know, I work Minneapolis. I work, you know, maybe 8 clubs a year. So I can still do clubs, but, you know, it's also the way the people who own the clubs are marketing them. And in San Francisco, both the clubs are owned by a giant corporation called Live Nation, which they're very tied into Comedy Central. So they get most of their comics from there.
Okay. And do you feel that you saw that coming over the 40 or so years of your career? Like, I've certainly had moments when I've stopped and thought, hang on a minute, I've got no CV.
How old are you?
I'm 38.
38?
Yeah.
So you're starting to feel the pressure too.
Well, I don't know that I feel under pressure, but I certainly feel that I've had moments of going, if I change my mind and want to do something else, then it had better be something to do with talking to people, because that's all. That's sort of my only. I've got no physical CV that I can give to someone. What have you been doing for 12 years? Well, I'm really good at driving at night. Do you know what I mean? You know. Yeah. So I wonder. Did you have a sense in advance? Like, is there? What I feared. I used to be a street performer. Ding. Take a drink now if you're playing along with the game at home. As a street performer, I remember seeing guys in their 50s doing street shows. Ooh. At Covent Garden. Ooh. And I remember thinking, I would love to be able to do a street show when I'm 50, but I don't want to have to.
Right.
Do you feel, obviously you have your column and your touring shows. Do you ever feel that your success as a comic is a cage in any way? Is it something that you have to keep doing, or is it something that you relish being able to keep doing?
No, I love getting out on stage, and you know, writing is wonderful, and doing radio commentaries and voiceovers and you know, whatever I do, when it works on stage, and where I make my money is from corporate gigs, because most of the corporate gigs are businessmen who are older, and because in my politics, I take out both sides. I'm kind of a bipartisan asshole. And they have to do business, you know, these businessmen, they have to do business with both sides of the politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, so they can see the humor on both sides.
Okay, and presumably corporate gigs pay rather more than club gigs. So it's almost like your audience has grown up with you.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask about something I'm very keen on asking my guests is, what bit of someone else's stuff do you most wish that you'd written?
Oh, there's so many. But, you know, I find it hard to watch other comedy because I'm afraid of material, you know, once again, seeping in and then bubbling up later on.
Sure.
So I don't watch a lot of comedy. But there's so many Lenny Bruce routines, you know, where he talks about the Catholic Church, and which I shouldn't mention. And George Carlin, just his use of words. Yeah.
If you had to review your own comedy, if you were a comedy critic, what would you say about your own act?
Oh man, I don't know. I can't see it. It's one of those forest for the trees things. All I know is all the interior, you know, the punches where I patched together something here, and I don't want some. I can't imagine looking at the house from the inside with new eyes anymore. I can't.
Okay. Well, tell us about Edinburgh. So how are you? Is this your first visit to the Edinburgh Fringe?
No, this is my eighth visit.
Eighth visit?
First time I came was 89.
Wow.
And yeah, I did a show at the Playhouse, and I was rooming with Mike Haley and Steve Coogan. Yeah, who were doing a double act back then.
Okay.
And it went well. And then I came back in 90, and that went well. And then I took a couple years off, and but I haven't been here since 2004.
Okay. So coming to it as a...
Totally different.
Yeah.
Jesus.
How's it changed? And what are the main things that you've noticed have changed?
Just the spaces and the crowds. And there it used to be predominantly comedy, but now it's... Jesus Christ. There's a lot of comics. And the Gilded and the Pleasance and then the Assemblies and the Stand and the Stand and the Stand and three more stands because there's actually six. So it just seems so much bigger. I don't know if it is.
There's lots of parallels between Edinburgh now and the Free Fringe in particular. I mean, here we are in the Black Medicine,
right,
which is a coffee shop on Nicholson Street in Edinburgh. And we're here as
with the most dangerous chairs in the world.
They are certainly very artistic. And we're here as part of PBH's Free Fringe, which is one of now four Free Fringe organisations. And there are lots of similarities between street performing and the Free Fringe in that you give people something for free. And only at the end do you talk about money. Nervous laughter. But there are lots of parallels. And I think it's really, it's giving people the opportunity to work, to perform in when they don't have to make an enormous financial commitment to it that would wipe out a lot of people.
Well, I'm fascinated by walking a slat. How did you figure that?
We can talk about it afterwards, Will. No.
Why, the audience has already heard this?
Well, this is episode 136 or something. I mention it. Every time I mention street performing, the audience at home has to take a drink because one of them. Similarly, whenever I use the word unpack. So... let's unpack something more
about
you. Let's talk about your club sets. When you work the clubs, are you doing... how long do you do? How long is a standard club set for you? Over here, it'd be like 20 to 30 minutes.
45 to an hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what you think of as a standard set is sort of what a lot of British comics are scraping to get together every year.
Yeah, but you're putting together a new hour every year. What are you doing this year?
How do you mean?
Are you doing?
Yes, I'm doing an hour. I'm doing my fifth hour at the Cannon's Gate.
At Cannon's Gate.
Yes. So
is
it a 70-seater underneath a pub?
Is it a brand new hour from last year?
Yes, it is. Yes.
How do you do that?
It's fucking killer.
It is. It is.
Yeah. It
coming because Woody Allen said writing a 45-minute stand-up set is like writing a novel. You know, because putting it together...
I've written a bad novel. It's a good stand-up set, but if you put it against the novel, I don't think you'd see the holes.
Yeah.
It's how often would you turn over material? And has that changed throughout your career?
I do 30 minutes of new material every year, and 20 minutes lasts. So in 2 years, I could write a brand new comedy set, 45 minutes.
Okay.
But it would take me 2 years. That's why people want me to come back the following year. And I say, let's skip a year.
And I'm busy. Come back. My diary is really full. Yeah.
It doesn't work every year, you know. So I come back every 2 years.
And when you're in writing mode, are you getting up? Are you the sort of person that goes, right, 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to do some writing? Or what does that look like?
Well, tonight.
Where do you sit?
What I do is I do a commentary. And the commentary is about 300 words, and I record it on my little computer. And hey, guys, Will Durst here with a few choice words on. Boom. And tonight it's going to be about authenticity because that's what the political guys in America, that's what is being rewarded. That's why Donald Trump is doing well and No, because he is authentic. There is no governor there, you know. And the other two people who are doing well, Ben Carson, who's an African-American brain surgeon who's never held elective office before, and he's running for the Republican nomination. And my joke is a black guy running for the Republican nomination has about the same chance as a black guy running for the Republican nomination. And then the other person who's doing well is Carly Fiorina. Okay. And she used to be the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, but she's never held elective office. So I'm going to write something on authenticity, you know, being the and also the fact that, you know, they're outsiders and, you know, they never held elective office before. And that's why they should be elected to run the country. You know, it's like, you know, hiring a brain surgeon, even though, you know, but he was a really good plumber. You know, so you're going to hire him as a brain surgeon because he's never held the office of a brain surgeon before. So I'll do that. I'll write that tonight. And then tomorrow I'll record it because I'll be drunk by the time I write this. And so tomorrow I'll record it and I'll send it off to 12 different radio stations. I'll tag each one differently. For Howie's Freaky Fat Friday, I'm Will Durst. For something else, I'm Will. So I tag each one individually.
Okay.
And then I send that out. And then that's the kernel for the column. That those 300 words will become the recorded on my little computer. And hey, guys, Will Durst here with a few choice words on. Boom. And tonight it's going to be about authenticity because that's what the political guys in America, that's what is being rewarded. That's why Donald Trump is doing well. And no, because he is authentic. There is no governor there, you know. And the other two people who are doing well, Ben Carson, who's an African-American brain surgeon who's never held elective office before, and he's running for the Republican nomination. And my joke is a black guy running for the Republican nomination has about the same chance as a black guy running for the Republican nomination. And then the other person who's doing well is Carly Fiorina. Okay. And she used to be the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, but she's never held elective office. So I'm going to write something on authenticity, you know, being the and also the fact that, you know, they're outsiders and, you know, they never held elective office before. And that's why they should be elected to run the country. You know, it's like, you know, hiring a brain surgeon, even though, you know, but he was a really good plumber. Yeah, so you're going to hire him as a brain surgeon because he's never held the office of a brain surgeon before. So I'll do that. I'll write that tonight. And then tomorrow I'll record it because I'll be drunk by the time I write this. And so tomorrow I'll record it and I'll send it off to 12 different radio stations. I'll tag each one differently. For Howie's Freaky Fat Friday, I'm Will Durst. For something else, I'm Will. So I tag each one individually.
Okay.
And then I send that out. And then that's the kernel for the column. That those 300 words will become the
And the stand-up page. Which do you find most satisfying?
Oh, both. At different times. Yeah. I wouldn't keep doing both if I didn't enjoy them. But there's something. And once again, I'm one of these people who write something, and I'm much more enamored of it than other people are. Yeah. Oh, it's a great column. Yeah, it was nice. No, you don't understand, because this, and then I did that, and it's fun.
And which column have you been most proud of? Is there one that sticks out for you? Is like, that's the one that I...
No, I can't. They're all babies. You can't pick your favorite baby, you know? It's like, my child. No, that was a good one. Yeah, he's a little deformed, but, you know, I still love him.
So do you think of yourself more as an artist or as an entertainer? And I'm talking about your stand-up here, not your column.
I'm a craftsman. I'm a Midwestern plotter. I know artists. I know guys. There was a guy named Bill Hicks, and he was wonderful. And he would either kill or die on stage. There was no in-between. The audience either loved him or they hated him. I see people walk out on him. And then others would, you know, demand that he be canonized and rise as one. But he was an artist, and he just kept – and I'm – I'm too much of a chameleon. I always go whichever way the audience wants. Because I think my job is to make people laugh out loud on purpose against their will. And that's already hard enough. But I'm not an artist, no.
That's interesting, that idea of making someone laugh against their will. I think those are the moments when I know I've got a good bit. If you can sort of think, this is undeniably funny.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if they hate me at this point. I can be tanking, but this thing will make them laugh because it's funny.
Every comic has that savor in the back of his act. You have that one moment where this one works with every audience, and you just and you approach it different. You know, you kind of, okay, you didn't like that, but then you go into that one. And then the only response you get is one guy in the back goes, huh. So, just like now, just like you guys.
I have to say, when I saw one of your very, I saw in fact your very first preview in the Gilded Balloon.
Yes, show, you did,
and it was not well attended, that first show.
That is a polite way of putting it.
It was not. Well, there were 11 people.
Yes,
and you played it like an absolute champion. I have to say, so I was sat there, you know, you walk in excited, going, okay, oh, I think it's just us. And I've seen some comedians really tank in this situation. I'm sure I've, over the years, I have killed potentially fun, low capacity, you know, low audience number gigs. But I thought you came out, I mean, are there any particular, like in all of your years of experience, have you got particular methods of dealing with adverse conditions?
No, I'm too silly to actually try to prepare it like that. What I have found, and you found this too, that you can have a dead full audience that is, you know, just not with you. They're just not on the same wavelength. And or you can have 8 people in the crowd and you get that feedback. And every room has something I call critical mass, that you need a critical mass of the amount of people in that room in order to really, and I was talking to Diane Spencer.
She's yes, at Diana the, Diane, yeah.
Yeah, she calls it ignition. She had the same theory that you need, and for the room that I'm in, it's about 50. I need about 50 people in there before, you know, the energy that they're giving me can feed off of my energy, and I can feed, you know, and it's, you know, like when they have one of those Tesla, you know, coils.
Yeah.
You know, you need that with the audience. You need a Tesla coil. And sometimes you can get it with 8 people, but hardly, yeah. Most of the time you need at least a third of the room full.
Ladies and gentlemen, if there are any questions, feel free to raise a hand. We have over 40 years of experience of the comedy world. Over the back. You said that you don't watch other comics, but are there any contemporary comics that you particularly enjoy?
There's a guy named Greg Proops. You know Proops?
Yeah, we know Proops.
Yeah. Well, he started out doing improv with my wife, so they're very good friends, and we go see him a lot. And I just enjoy the hell out of him. He's funnier than fuck.
Any others?
Oh, can I say fuck?
That is a fantastic question. Are you already familiar with the podcast? Are you someone that's come?
Because
you're going to love it, mate. If you go, okay. Do you? And I want to word this exactly right for the sake of the recording. Say it again. Do you think that a comedian touring is an attempt to run away from the responsibilities of adult life?
Yes. comics are weird, you know? I mean, there's so many comics, and you hear all the thing about the depression that Stuart mentioned that he was going to bring up, and I am one of the guys who I'm kind of happy. I don't really care. But yeah, I know there's a lot of comics, you know, you hear them talk about, oh, but their kid and they love their kid and, oh, here's pictures of his kid. And then you will, dude, you've been on the road for 2 months, you know, don't you ever see your kid? Well, yeah, but I love my kid. And then you end up with, they just use it for materials sometimes.
Do you think that comedy, do you think the business, the industry of comedy, do you think it's a meritocracy?
I'd say 40% of it is. Yeah. I'd say 60% is having the right people and being in the right place And but yeah, unless you're still doing it, you won't be in the right place. The only people still doing it are the ones who never quit. So it a lot of it has to do. But you're also right. I mean, we've lost so many good comics through all sorts of things. You know, there was drugs in the 80s, and there was booze and illnesses, you know. Lost Bill Hicks to pancreatic cancer. We lost Warren Thomas about 15 years ago, which was a great loss to the comedy community. So our family responsibilities, I mean, you lose – it's very rare for a comic to be able to keep on that path. You know, there's so many other distractions and real-life responsibilities that are pulling you back. And
did you – how come you have survived? How come you
– Debbie and I don't have kids because we are kids, you know. It wouldn't be fair. Also, that phrase, adults produce children, but children produce adults. Well, we were never willing to take the risk.
Yeah. Are you still angry? And if not, is that due to your age?
I think the anger in the beginning was evidenced on stage, perhaps with a less sophisticated approach. And the anger, I think it's easier to make a better point with just by being a little smoother, you know, and not necessarily letting the anger take over. You still have to have, I mean, I read the newspapers about these idiots and what they talk about, and I get so pissed at listening to Fox News, and I'll scream, but I'll try to make it funny. I think that's the first part. You got to make it funny. Because, we're not going to change the way people think. What we can do is we can plant seeds for a future that may grow, you know, if watered by the blood of the patriot tree, you know. No, but eventually, you know, you can empower people. What you can do on stage, you can empower them to make them think that, yeah, that's what I thought, you know, that their opinion is just as important as what they're being told. Because sometimes the issue seems so complex and people just go, oh, whatever he says is fine. You know, and no, you can, yeah, your first instinct was right on this. And if you can make it funny, because I think laughter allows hope to, you know, come back on the inhale. And I think that's what comedy is, that's a major function, what we do. We are the famous thing, we're the canaries in the coal mine, you know, we're the first ones to sense the danger. Well,
do you think there is, just staying with that emotional contact, and you mentioned lots of comedians that we've lost to, I know some to suicide and some to drug overdoses. Do you have any time for the kind of the tears of a clown notion? Do you think that comics are more liable to depression than anyone else?
See, you did get there. Yeah, well, it's lonely, and I think one of the reasons that comics seek out this profession has to do with, you know, perhaps dealing with that issue. And because universal love, as opposed, you know, not tonight, but sometimes, you know, when you get it on stage, it's a balm, you know, it gets you through the day. And if you have enough days that you can get through, who knows?
The gentleman's asking about the difference between audience reactions, not just in terms of the cultural references that you're making, but do you find a difference between American or British or even Scottish audiences? Do you find that...
They're a little more reserved over here. They take umbrage a little faster. They aren't looking necessarily for the joke. They want the joke... given to them, they won't see it. But the same, you know, it's has to do with, but the references thing, I like that part. I like learning the different references. I had someone mess with me because I do a joke about Waldo. Where's Waldo? That, you know, I don't even know who I am anymore, you know, because I get 18 different usernames because I can't be Wilders because that's already taken. So even at Starbucks, when they ask for your name, I don't want everybody to know my name at a Starbucks. So I tried being Ace, you know, but but I couldn't keep a straight face. What's your name? Ace. So now I'm Waldo, because one out of six people, you know, six times will go, where's Waldo? You know, now you're playing my game. But someone told me that over here you don't have Waldo, you got Wally. But that doesn't work. I tried. Where's Waldo? It doesn't have the same boom, you know, that Waldo has. So I went back to Waldo. It still works. Yeah. Because, yeah. So you guys are able to make a lot of leaps.
Well done, Britain. Well done. Ladies and gentlemen, before we wrap up, I said...
Oh, you were wonderful, Stuart Goldsmith. Oh, what a great interview. Thank you
so much.
You're indomitable. Just keep going.
I said before we wrap up, and thanks for getting the compliment. Now we're going to get stuck in. No, I just wanted to ask finally whether you got what you wanted from comedy. Like, people go into it for lots of different reasons. Whether 40 years later you could look back at the 22-year-old Will Durst and say,
oh, man, I was so lucky. I had so many wonderful times, you know, so many moments. And I didn't leave a legacy, you know, which I guess is what I wanted. But
what kind of legacy would you have been happy with?
He changed the world. But I did get to go to the White House. I was friends with a woman who married Hillary Clinton's brother, so we got invited to the White House. And we got to meet Bill and Hillary, and got kicked out of the White House, actually.
What did you get kicked out of the White House?
Oh, it was like 10 p.m., and the chief of protocol said, all right, everybody out. And I said, I've been kicked out of better places than this. And she said, name one. It was hysterical.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the brilliant Mr. Will Durst.
Thanks so much.
And that's that, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening. My thanks to Will Durst, thanks to Nathan Wood, Olivia Phipps, and Sarsky Anderson, my fiance, who is assisting me with lots of stuff, including the Break Glass project, which I didn't mention before because I mentioned so many things. If you have any further things, we've got 34 entrants now and I'm sifting my way through them. If you have a particularly inspiring moment from the podcast back catalogue that you would like to be on this new music-based compilation, then to Break Glass in case of emergencies to listen to when you've died on your ass at a gig or failed at a job interview or whatever. If you want to hear your favourite comics talking about how they pick themselves up, set over some stirring music by Mr. Steve Dunn, then tweet me at ComComPod with the hashtag BreakGlass. And suggest with the timing on the episode as well in numbers, if that's possible, if you're feeling if you're that conversant with it, send me your most uplifting moments. You can also do that on the ComCom Facebook group. Exciting YouTube news coming soon. And you know me, when Goldsmith says soon, he means within 2 to 4 months. That's all for now. I'll speak to you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.